visit the Screening Room, Kingston's only independent movie theater located downtown at 120 Princess Street. They specialize in playing art house, international classic, and cult cinema, along with Hollywood's best new releases. People also always say they have the best popcorn in town. Visit Screening Room at screeningroom.com for upcoming show dates and ticket information.
You're listening to CFRC 101.
Hey, what's up? My name is Decisive, and you are listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome, everyone. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
This is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, July 11th, 2025. I'm Breanne Doyle. This week on Rabble Radio, Rabble editor Nick Seabrook speaks with Dr. Yipeng Ji, one of over 4,000 people from around the world who joined the Global March to Gaza. The Global March to Gaza attempted to reach the Rafah border crossing between Egypt and Palestine, aiming to draw global attention to the blockade of Gaza and call for an end to the siege. Here are Nick Seabrook and Yipeng Ji in conversation. Take a listen.
Dr. Ji, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So I guess to get started, can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and your background?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm a family doctor and have also been trained in public health, understanding the impacts of structural determinants of health, things like colonialism and how that affects people's health here in the context of Canada, the settler colonial context of Canada. And I've also studied the health of Palestinians in the context of occupied Palestine, understanding the impacts of colonialism as it affects health there as well. And I am calling in from the unceded, unsurrendered territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabeg, also known as Ottawa, and that's where I also work as a family doctor.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And can you tell us a little bit about the Global March to Gaza and what that was?
Yeah, the Global March to Gaza was a people, citizen, volunteer-led effort that happened a few weeks ago, where over 4,000 people from 80 different countries went to Cairo, Egypt, to attempt to march to the Rafah border to bring international attention and pressure to the ongoing blockade and siege held by the Israelis, aided and abetted by other countries like Egypt, to deny essential humanitarian aid, like food, medicine, water, baby formula, to the entirety of the Gaza Strip. This happened in the context of multiple freedom flotillas that were also attempting to bring aid into Gaza by sea. The next one actually departing in a few days on the 13th of July. And this also was in the context of the Tunisian Samoud convoy that left Tunisia, attempted to move by land with a convoy of over 150 cars and trucks with, I think, around 2,000 people. They were stopped in eastern Libya before they could enter Egypt. And we just saw all of these people-led efforts be quashed by states that are complicit in allowing Israel to continue its genocide and also allowing the blockade to kind of continue, the famine to continue.
Now, Rabble, we covered a press conference that you participated in on Parliament Hill just before you left for the Global March to Gaza. Was this march something that came together fairly quickly or had been in the works for a while?
It was something that I think was being planned fairly quickly, but it was something that was being kind of managed by the organizers for at least a couple of months. But I know many of the participants signed up fairly last minute because there was a degree of skepticism of, like, was this going to be possible? Like, myself, I signed up to join as a participant around a week before the march began. So it was a very last minute decision to join. And I think because it was, you know, a lot of people were skeptical of, were we going to be able to do it? Unfortunately, we were not successful in marching to the Rafah border crossing because the Egyptian authorities really stopped everyone, even at the airport. Coming in, people were detained and arrested and deported, and even just attempting to gather in Cairo or in Ismailia was really challenging. This was even before the Egyptian Sinai, which would require Egyptian authority approval. So the planning of it, I think, was fairly extensive. I wasn't part of the organizing committee myself, but I know that there's also many efforts now to build on the momentum of what had taken place in Egypt, taken place in Tunisia, to build on a Sumud flotilla kind of effort so that many different people who have been mobilized will continue to mobilize as to do what they can to kind of bring aid into Gaza through through the sea.
Now, obviously, participating in something like this is, you know, there was risk involved. It's a significant commitment of time and resources on your part. Why did you feel it was important for you to participate in this march?
I think personally for myself, as someone who's studied the impacts of colonialism on health in the context of Canada affecting Indigenous, First Nations, Inuit, Métis peoples, that's what led me to the question of Palestine. And having also witnessed the conditions of apartheid and occupation in the West Bank, and then having volunteered in primary care clinics as a medical volunteer in central Rafah in Gaza during this genocide, I know that the solution for the people of Palestine is ultimately liberation. And it's through these meaningful solidarity efforts to end the siege and the blockade and the occupation and the genocide. This is the solution. Like it is international solidarity efforts in coordination and in direction with what Palestinian voices and narratives are telling us from the ground, to be able to use all the mechanisms necessary within our toolbox to be in full solidarity with the Palestinian people to end the conditions of occupation and genocide and apartheid. And we really take that kind of direction with seriousness and with a strong conviction for what we need to do in this moment. And we need to do everything to be able to prevent and end genocide. We've utterly failed as an international community, with the obligation really on states, on different states around the world, to end and prevent genocide. But that has utterly failed the people of Palestine because of those systems of oppression, namely Zionist colonialism, imperialism, and capitalism, that make this genocide a profitable one. But the people of conscience around the world, I think, refuse to put profits over people, to put these interests above the people's right to self-determination, liberation, dignity, the right to life. And so in understanding this, when we have that privilege and that opportunity and the resources to contribute to a solidarity movement in this way, I think it means that we must. And so it just became really clear to me that this was something that I needed to do, not only for the people of Palestine, but also for myself, right? I think people have said, do you really think that you folks, or like you as a person, can change the world? And one of the things I think back on is, some other people have also reflected on this, it's not about changing the world per se. It's also not letting the world change us and the ways in which we see the world and the values and principles and the morals that we have. And so we will continue to mobilize and organize to do what we can for the people of Palestine as they experience an ongoing genocide. But we also know that the liberation of Palestine and for Palestinians also comes from their actions, their resistance, their resilience, their steadfastness on the ground. But it doesn't absolve us of the responsibility in the West in particular, when our states, our governments are the most complicit in this genocide, as they, for example, Canada continues to send arms and weapons, normalize relations with Israel, and continues to provide diplomatic and political cover for Israel.
Now, you mentioned hostility that you experienced on the ground in Egypt. People who followed you on social media could see that this came both from official government representatives as well as regular Egyptian people on the ground who were hostile to people trying to get to the Rafah border crossing. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that entailed whenever you got to Egypt, what that was like and what you experienced?
So some of the people that were participating in the march, but also others that were not participating in the march, but looked like they might have been because they were foreigners or they looked like foreigners, were caught up in this frenzy of the Egyptian authorities trying to identify who they assumed or suspected to be a part of the march, and essentially arrested, detained, and deported a lot of people. This happened at the airport, where some people and delegations didn't even make it out of the airport, and they were deported back to their country of departure. And others made it to their hotels in downtown Cairo, for example, and then they were rounded up in their hotels and detained and then later deported from the airport. Those others that managed to find their way into Cairo, because they could not stop everyone, we tried to gather in Ismailia, which is a couple kilometers away from central Cairo. The drive is, not too far. It's about like 30 minutes to 40 minutes, I think. But there's a few different checkpoints. They're essentially toll booths, not actually formal military checkpoints, between Cairo and Ismailia. And at multiple checkpoints, people were stopped with their passports confiscated, and some were told to get your passport back. You have to agree to go to the airport and be deported, essentially. And so that was the day of trying to gather as a group. And at the first checkpoint, there were approximately 300, 400 people, to my understanding, that were stopped. And then the second checkpoint, there were upwards, if not more than 1,000 people that were stopped. And I was stopped at the second checkpoint with many others. And later, what we experienced after most people's passports were given back was there were agitators, and there were news reports of these being paid agitators that came and disrupted the group, attacked the people that were still there at the second checkpoint, forcing them onto buses so that they would go back to central Cairo, some of whom were deported, some of whom were held on buses for upwards of 12 hours. My friends who actually made it to Ismailia, they were rounded up from the streets of Ismailia, from a cafe, on their way to a hotel, being suspected of being a part of the march. And they were essentially detained on these buses for over 12 hours, all to kind of intimidate, all to dissuade people from gathering as a group, to really show and demonstrate the people power of the people who stand in solidarity with Palestine.
Now, a question about that hostility from Egypt. You know, Egypt is an Arab state, Libya, another Arab state, both authoritarian governments. Why are they preventing activists like yourself from trying to get to the Rafah border crossing? What is their interest in helping to support Israel?
You know, there's a lot of different ways, I think, to look at this. I mean, the very obvious reason is we think about where the borders of Zionism really lie in the region, and Zionist, like, settler colonialism as a process doesn't happen within a vacuum. Genocide and apartheid doesn't happen within a vacuum. If the countries and states around the region truly saw what was happening as wrong and they wanted to take action to end that, they have many different levers at their disposal to do that. But they are ultimately collaborators in what Israel is doing through these kinds of normalized diplomatic political relations. And what happened in the days, in the immediate day before the march really began, was an Israeli minister, I believe it was like the interior minister or something like that, basically said Egypt cannot allow this march to happen. And that communication obviously was you know, taken quite seriously by the Egyptian authorities at the highest levels. And that was what was communicated down to the police officers that were detaining and arresting people with no good reason. I remember one of my friends who was caught up in this 12-hour detainment on the bus, and he asked the police officer, what did we do wrong? What laws did we break? And basically, they said none. And that's also why they were ultimately released after the 12 hours, I think. And they were just told, we're following orders, right? We're just doing our job. We're following orders. And, it, you know, we have to understand that, for example, Egypt, the broader kind of like political, social context of what's happened over the past, you know, 21 months as well. There have been students, activists, journalists who have been detained because of just trying to organize something for Palestine. Some of these people, you know, tens of thousands of political prisoners for many different reasons, but some of them try to organize things for Palestine, even on their own student campuses in Egypt, and are still being held by the Egyptian authorities. And then the list kind of goes on, where the Egyptian Hala company charged thousands of dollars for Palestinians from Gaza who wanted to exit Gaza. And then those that exited for medical evacuation reasons find themselves in Egyptian hospitals and receiving extremely substandard care. I've even visited some of these patients in the Egyptian hospitals, and they express that they want to even go back to Gaza, knowing the conditions in Gaza. Despite knowing those conditions, they would rather go back because of the conditions in these Egyptian hospitals. And then you have the many tens of thousands of Palestinians who are now displaced in Egypt, who voluntarily left through, you know, paying the Egyptian Hala company, for example, and not having papers to be able to work or study. And so the layers of kind of this oppression of Palestinians in Egypt is, you know, yet another kind of example of how these countries in the region, these states around Israel, do collaborate in the systemic oppression of Palestinians.
For Canada, we talked about the Canadian government. What is the Canadian government's responsibility here? What do you want to see the Canadian government do in response to the ongoing genocide in Gaza?
You know, there's so many groups that have articulated this for almost 2 years now, right? And actually many groups have raised the alarm bells for a slow genocide that was happening in Palestine because of the occupation and apartheid conditions that many human rights organizations had previously already raised the alarm bells around, which Canada has an obligation under international law to prevent and end genocide. Full stop. And Canada has actually refused to do so by continuing to send arms to Israel, whether it be direct trade or through other companies, Canadian companies that are sending parts to the U.S. for building warfare technology that are later sent to Israel to bomb Palestinians. You know, and a very easy example is GasStops, a Canadian Ottawa-based manufacturing company that creates the engine sensors that fits into the F-35 fighter jets built in the U.S. by Lockheed Martin and then sent to Israel for Israel to fly those planes over Gaza to drop 2,000-pound bombs on a largely civilian population. And so the least that Canada can do, and actually in obligation under their own kind of international pieces of legislation that they signed, is to end those arms trades, to actually put in a meaningful two-way arms embargo. There are other things that Canada can and should do that I think also align with these obligations, which is cancel free trade. Canada still has an ongoing trade agreement with Israel. Sanctions, meaningful sanctions on the Israeli war cabinet, the Israeli government that are committing these atrocities, these war crimes, these crimes that are being investigated by the International Court of Justice, by the International Criminal Court. And you know, there are other things that Canada can also do, which is prosecute dual national citizens, that there are Canadians that have participated in these war crimes and crimes against humanity and genocide being perpetrated by the Israeli military. And so these individuals should be prosecuted under Canadian law and jurisdiction for their involvement in the genocide. And of course, this is not a solution. Like, humanitarian aid is not a solution, because what ultimately Palestinians need is, you know, a sovereign, self-determined healthcare system led by the people and for the people. But in the meantime, it is not to undermine the existing humanitarian system, but that has continuously been undermined over the past 2 years, is to properly fund, you know, the WHO, the United Nations, UNRWA, to be able to deliver humanitarian aid in a way that is meaningful. But for the past months now, we've seen a decimation of that system by Israel and by the US to create something called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which is delivering scarce amounts of food aid by American mercenaries. And then Israeli gunshot fire has killed many, many people, massacred people in the hundreds, sometimes on a daily basis at these so-called aid distribution sites, after they have completely decimated the existing humanitarian aid delivery framework in the Gaza Strip, largely coordinated by the United Nations. And so if Canada cares about an international world order post the creation of the United Nations, Canada has to meaningfully stand up and use its diplomatic and political levers to pressure Israel to stop what it's doing. And there was a recent letter, I believe, coordinated by Norway, around support for the ICC and its jurisdiction to do their work independently. And Canada applauds themselves about its role in the creation of the ICC, and yet didn't even sign on to this letter that was presented at Human Rights Council at the United Nations just, I believe, a week or so ago. And so we see the ways in which Canada continues to really undermine its own obligations and its clear double standards around maintaining a sense of humanity and morality in this world. But, you know, in some ways, it's clear to me that Canada is also doing what it's always done. Canada is a settler colonial state that has committed and continues to commit genocide on this land in many different forms now. And with that kind of colonial interest in mind, it continues to uphold a colonial outpost in the region, being Israel, and those interests are in alignment, still continuously, because of those interests of capital, and colonial and imperial interests, that there are Canadian companies, for example, that profit generously, because of the, genocide, because of conflict, because of war, is just so awfully profitable, largely because of the American military industrial complex being so tied with Canada's companies as well.
Now that you've returned to Canada after the march, you know, we're seeing the genocide in Gaza continue. We're seeing countries like the US and Israel continue to undermine these international institutions that you've been talking about just this week. Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur for the UN on Gaza, was sanctioned by the US. My question is, what are the next steps here for you as an activist on this issue, and for those who want to get involved and make a difference? What do we do next?
You know, there's so much to do. I think ultimately we have to pick things that make sense strategically, that put our energy and time into things that will effectively move something forward in a meaningful way. And to do that requires collective efforts, requires working with other people to really address some of those pain points in moving the dial towards Palestinian liberation. I really look towards the boycott, divestment, BDS movement that recently passed its 20-year anniversary, a movement led by Palestinian civil society as a peaceful, nonviolent movement for what's been tried and true to end apartheid, for example, in South Africa. And to use these ways to kind of educate others about the ties in which companies, workplaces, grocery stores, pension plans, academic institutions has ties in normalizing an apartheid state committing genocide. like, let that be a window of opportunity to welcome people into a broader movement for liberation for Palestinians, and to do the collective action that is necessary, whether it be through ending that complicity in your workplace, through your union, through your pension plan, through your academic institutions, you know, so whatever we do, it has to be strategic, it has to be targeted, it has to be effective in the ways that can also help build a movement so that it's sustainable. You know, colonialism in the West was not built overnight. And so we have to, I think, temper our efforts to be sustainable so that we will work towards dismantling these forms of oppression over a long period of time, inviting many more people into the movement. I will be attending the Freedom Flotilla launch in southern Italy in a few days, because the Handala boat is taking off from southern Italy on July 13th as another effort to break the siege. But there are so many different movements all around us. And it's just picking something, spending time and energy on it, building the connections and the relationships necessary so that we can continue this struggle sustainably for the long term.
All right. And there's so much more to say on this issue, but unfortunately, we're at the end of our time. Dr. Yiping Zhi, thank you so much for your work on this matter. Thank you so much for your advocacy. And thank you for taking the time to speak with us today about it.
Thank you for having me, Nick. Appreciate it.
From Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, I am Yara Hawari, and this is Rethinking Palestine. In mid-June 2025, thousands of international solidarity activists planned to march from El Arish in the Egyptian Sinai to the Rafah border in Gaza in what was dubbed the Global March to Gaza. The participants came from over 80 countries, many from Europe, and they included individual activists, solidarity groups, and trade unions. As expected, the participants barely made it out of Cairo before they were stopped by the Egyptian authorities. They were sent back to the Egyptian capital, some were detained and others forcibly deported. It's clear that the organisers of the march knew they wouldn't reach Rafah, and many activists have since stressed that the aim was to highlight the complicity of the Egyptian regime in the blockade and to put some kind of international pressure on it. Now, this is not the first attempt to breach the blockade on Gaza. Over the last nearly 18 years, there have been various attempts by sea and land, and with them have come many discussions about the effectiveness and importance of such actions. Indeed, though these actions often capture some media attention, especially if public figures are involved, like the recent case of Greta Thunberg, and provide symbolic support, they rarely make changes to the material reality on the ground. But is this what is expected of international solidarity? To only participate in actions that have a real life effect, or is there room for symbolic support? To discuss this with me on this episode of Rethinking Palestine is Inji Sarhan. Inji is a researcher pursuing a master's degree in modern Middle Eastern studies at the University of Oxford. She is also one of the five founding members of Collective, a platform for resource sharing among artists, writers, and curators in Egypt and the Arab world. Inji, thank you for joining me on this episode of Rethinking Palestine.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for opening the space to discuss this at this point in time.
Inji, you recently published an article with the Egyptian media platform Mada Masr that asked some critical questions about mobilizations such as the Global March to Gaza. Perhaps you can start off by telling us a bit about what unfolded and contextualize it in the history of international attempts at solidarity with Gaza in Egypt.
I think I want to start by saying that the text is kind of a piece of reflection on recent events that happened through discussions with other people in the same time. Many people around me were having these discussions, but there was no one place in which we can funnel down these ideas. And I think this is where the push to write came. The other thing that might be important to mention here is that I've seen a lot of people tweet around the time. I think it's something to the effect of what you said in your introduction, as expected, that it was crushed. As expected, people were drawing a lot of parallels between this march to Gaza and a similar march that took place in 2009. Back in 2009, I was very young, so I don't have a vivid memory of what that meant. So I had to kind of like turn into research and like try to read this moment backwards from the position of today. And I found a very comprehensive article on the electronic intifada that was published early January 2010. So it was shortly after the events of this attempt has happened. And what I could tell from this article is also something that I discussed with a friend, is that history is a distorted mirror. So much of what was in that article could be applied to today's context if you just swap some dates. And I think it made me think, since we have a precedent, since we have this in recent memory, 2009 is not that far away from today. It made me question a lot about what was happening in 2025 and how it relates to 2009 and how we can see both as a continuity, not as moments of rupture, actually. And I think I mentioned this in the article, but I think from both instances, what's happening today and what I read in the 2009 article, you can see similar tactics. You can see soft detention. You can see the focus on media attention, the focus on it becoming a spectacle of protest and containment, whereas visibility is prioritized over strategic planning. It also raised a lot of concerns on performative activism and the privilege of mobility. Like, you really start to think, who has the privilege to just drop everything, get a ticket to Cairo, and then just go, not knowing what is the end goal of this action. And whether directly or indirectly, I think it ended up distracting media and public discourse from the ongoing genocidal violence inside Gaza to what was actually happening with protesters on the other side of the border, or like slightly outside. I think people don't understand the context in Egypt. People were sometimes texting me, just because I'm Egyptian, it was really random. Like, they would be saying something like, have you heard of this? And again, I was also very, not hesitant, but doubtful that this would ever go through. And I remember sometimes I would just screenshot the map of Egypt and draw a line over the Suez Canal. And I can tell them, like, this would be as far as one can go if you try to attempt a similar type of protest, just because of like my experience of traveling into Sinai. You know, how many checkpoints one has to go through if you're just going to Sharm el-Sheikh or Dahab or somewhere else for vacation, let alone like we're talking about northern Sinai when you have a direct border with Gaza. So I think people lack this basic understanding just because they look at a map and they think they can understand how to get there from point A to B, not knowing what sorts of obstacles are between points A and B. And yeah, I think this is what I can say to that first point, that it was really helpful for me to read the events of today through the lens of what happened in 2009, see how it was probably similar intent, probably similar scale. The only difference is that back then there was a lot of support from the French embassy, for example, which is absent today. Even though the embassy technique was invoked at some points, people were like, call your embassies, ask them to come and defend you. But we all know the position of those embassies today. We all know how complicit they are, and we all know that they really don't care. And the second thing is to look at what happened in 2009 and apply it to today, and then understand how when the initial intention of protest fails, how those groups resort to symbolic actions, probably in Cairo, not knowing what would this lead into. And by this, I mean hunger strikes, vigils, and flash mobs, and all sorts of these actions.
Angie, something you said really struck with me, that visibility was prioritized over strategic planning. Can you unpack that a little bit more?
If you go to their social media channels, official social media channels, which in this place and time act as like an official means of understanding what this campaign is about, what you would see and what is hyper visible, and I think we can here speak only to what we see. I cannot speak to what's happening, you know, internally. What you see is a lot of quasi influencers that are being brought to Cairo to launch what would be called in that instance awareness campaigns. They want to draw international attention to what's happening in Gaza. And then by being in Cairo and trying to break the siege, they are redirecting this international awareness or international media attention. But I think something here that we can, there needs to be a pushback on the lack of awareness. Gaza is not absent from the news lines. It's It's been present in the news lines for the last 2 years. So this technique applies to other struggles, other causes where media stops reporting on them, where media avoids reporting on them. I don't think this is the case with Gaza. And I think it's really, there's something very flattening in applying this blanket claim that there hasn't been enough media coverage or there's no media coverage, so we need to use the media tactic. So there was this. And I think also the idea of gathering masses, focusing on numbers, where 1,400 activists from 80 countries and whatnot, all of these things becomes a currency in which you can basically present something. So I would say the focus was on this rather than material aid. We don't know if there was any aid involved. As far as I know, I've seen tweets of people stuck on the first or the second checkpoint to Ismailia with no water and sending out emergency appeals for people to bring water and food trucks from Cairo. So what is your role in that situation? I thought you were going there to deliver aid. I thought you were going there to help break the siege. There's also something in, like, when you read the official statements on the website of the march, it feels like a safari program. We are going to arrive in Cairo on June 12th or 13th, and then we're going to go by bus to Al Arish. And then from that point onwards, we're going to march for 3 days. There was even a program of marching between 7 and 10 a.m. and then a break, because I don't think anyone can tolerate walking in the sun and the heat, and then continue marching again between 5 and 9. And then after that, there's a sit-in staged outside the Rafah border on the Egyptian side. The sit-in was supposed to last 3 days. And then there was like the last line in the program, return to Cairo and leave. So I think something about this was, for me, very disturbing to read, because it reads like a recreational program or something that I would sign up to if I want to go like on do tourism or something. And for me, something didn't sit right with this. And it made me just question, what is the point? What is the actual goal? What is behind all of this? What are we going to do if we gather a lot of people and we sit outside the Rafah border for 3 days? What is this going to do to people on the other side? Also thinking of the ethical weight of what does it mean when I'm sitting outside the borders of a place that has been actively bombed by Israel for the last almost 2 years.
If you're enjoying this podcast, please visit our website, al-shabaka.org, where you will find more Palestinian policy analysis and where you can join our mailing list and donate to support our work.
I think at best, it kind of highlights the sort of naivety of a lot of these activists. But I think that also takes away, assuming that this is just naivety, takes away agency from these people. Because as you said, this isn't about raising awareness. The genocide in Gaza has been live streamed and covered by the people that are facing the genocide themselves for the last nearly 2 years. And so it's no longer a question about narrative. I think the Palestinians and the Palestinian struggle for liberation has won the narrative in this moment. I think there is no question about genocide and the mass horror that is being inflicted upon the Palestinian people. We have the literal proof of that on our phones every day, every minute, every second. You know, the last thing you said about sort of the lack of forward thinking in terms of basic logistics, it just strikes me that this put a lot of undue stress on local activists, people who would rightly be concerned about international comrades and people coming to their country and being placed in unsafe situations.
I'm just going to answer the second part of your question first. I would agree that this happened, but again, when I read the 2009 article, something very striking, like one of the last paragraphs was talking about the absence of Egyptian representation. It said in previous, and I'm quoting here, in previous incidents during the Gaza Freedom March, except for the syndicate of journalists, the relative absence of Egyptian participation and solidarity with the Gaza Freedom March could have been interpreted by delegates as the result of either severe political repression or political indifference. But anti-government Egyptian activists pointed out that the Gaza Freedom organizers failed to reach out to them and establish coordination. In fact, Egyptian labor unions, students, and organizations of civil society have a long history of struggle in the streets of Cairo and other towns for democratic rights in the face of the overwhelming force of the state apparatus. 6 full days of political demonstrations in Cairo by a large group of visiting internationals is without historical precedent. And I think it's really important to understand that this moment in 2009, you had active labor unions, you had active student unions, you had active political organizations. And even then, it's mentioned in the article, even then, no one was contacted, no one was reached out to. So I think there's a little bit of arrogance in kind of thinking this, you can just go to this new terrain, new context without really doing any basic reading, basic research, trying to understand and thinking that you can just survive there. And I think the other thing is that similarly this time around, people sounded the alarm. I've seen reports online of, or articles online asking activists to, like, when you come to Cairo, so at this point, like, they're not even trying to stop them, but they're trying to kind of do damage control. So it said, when you come to Cairo, try to stay away from mutual aid networks, because if you try to approach them, you risk exposing them. So I think there was a lot of advice or a lot of crucial context being provided that in the end was dismissed. Was dismissed because people thought they could do better, or that they are doing action for the sake of action without really thinking of consequences. And because also there's the privilege of exit. Basically, I can go and leave. Or that they really don't have an understanding of what it means to engage with the police in Egypt, for example. Maybe their experience with engaging with the police is one of, for example, the UK or Germany, where basically you have some sort of police clash, they escort you to a police station, and then maybe they do fingerprints, maybe someone is sent and they do police station support, and then maximum you spend the evening in a police station and then you release, no consequences, or like no major consequences, more or less. So I think there's a discrepancy here that might have not been taken into account in that instance. I also agree that it's not really about changing the narrative. I saw once in a protest a banner that was very silly, but it said so many things. It said, no one can say they didn't know. So by this point, it's not really about kind of bringing to light something that is off the table. It's more or less about either using similar tactics to what people have been used to before without really realizing how the situation on the ground has changed. And I think a lot of the critique that was directed at people asking international activists not to hail on Egypt was like, what do you want us to do? Do nothing. And the response to this was not do nothing, but at the same time, you have to maybe think of what you should target that would have the most efficient material change for people on the ground. So basically, if you live in a country that directly finances the genocide, you have to aim at directing, changing policy, not in changing narrative. If you live somewhere close to a weapons factory, then you might have to do something in relation to that weapons factory, as opposed to thinking of, you know, a symbolic action that might bring into light the suffering of the Palestinian people. I think just to sum it up in short, people sometimes invoke sensational parts of the reality of the genocide to have some sort of urgency. So they would say, we need to do this because the children of Gaza are starving. But my response to this is, if you really care about the starving children of Gaza, start engaging more seriously with mutual aid. Fundraise so that they can have access to flour. People sometimes say, we're heeding the calls of the Palestinians. Yes, but the Palestinians, when they call on people, they ask that you surround embassies, you know, Zionist embassies, U.S. embassies, buildings or institutions of true political power that have actually the authority and the possibility to overturn something, the possibility to change the material conditions on the ground with the speed that matches the scale of the carnage. So I think, again, like, people tend to conflate a lot what they invoke in order to achieve what without really that being questioned.
And I think part of this is an outcome of social media, where people prioritize these symbolic, flashy, Instagrammable protests over real political work, which, to be honest, is more often than not very tedious, very monotonous, very thankless, not, you know, Instagrammable at all, but is necessary and vital in building a movement. And the fact that many of these activists and figures came from the global north and came from Europe is really significant. There was some research published the other day that, contrary to what a lot of people think, the EU is actually the biggest investor in Israel, not America, the EU. And so there is actually a lot of work for these people to be doing at home. And in many cases, I think it's more important to be engaged in that kind of work rather than the symbolic protest. But I want to bring us to one of the talking points that a lot of the organizers or the people involved used as a sort of, you know, acknowledging the passport privilege and the white privilege of participants and insisting that that can be used as a mechanism for leverage. So in other words, the logic was that they could do things that local activists or, you know, Arab activists could not do, or at least they would be afforded more safety, than local activists. So what do you think about that kind of defense or argument?
In the article, I mentioned white privilege a couple of times, but I think in that specific instance, I would prefer to stick more to passport privilege, because whiteness here is more a construct in relation to proximity of power structures rather than race or skin complexion. And I think it's also important, because maybe this is something that I missed while writing that article, that some of the participants in the march were also Arab organizers that are coming from either Arab countries or from Western countries. So it means that they have a certain passport privilege. And I think one feedback that I got was that I put everyone in the same basket. And this is something that I kind of acknowledge doing, whether willingly or not. But I think in the same way that I demand a differentiated approach when I write in the article that we should have the clear-eyed distinction between state policy and popular will, I think I would like to use the same framework and allow it to lend itself to separate organizers from participants. And I think this is really important in any kind of organizing structure where the question of accountability kind of comes forward. So again, what I wrote about was mostly that which was hyper-visible. And then going into that, I think there was a lot of, like you said, a lot of people thought that their privilege would afford them safety to do certain actions where their, you know, Arab, Egyptian or Palestinian counterparts could not be afforded the same privileges. But I think also it's important to think what's at stake. A lot of the people who would engage in similar acts of protest are probably acting on white guilt, are probably acting with a certain level of white fragility, and are probably acting with a certain level of white saviorism. And I think there's something to be said about going into solidarity movements for identity building. There's a lot of privilege in choosing which struggles do you want to support, and also, like, in turn, which struggles you can just decide to walk away from. I've met a lot of people in my life who will say something like, I think I will prioritize working on the climate struggle for the next period. But for others, this is a part of their reality. This is not something that they can afford actually to walk away from, even if they wanted to. And I think this is what sets apart a lot of considerations in which people would take in that position, but also how one can act while being principled. I understand that the response is a lot of outrage, and it's very understandable to be outraged by also the helplessness. But at the same time, taking any action in that specific context, taking any action because you want to break the siege or stop the genocide and all of these things, A, it should be understood within the larger struggle for liberation. And then the second thing is that it shouldn't be so that you feel good, so that you, you're able to ease your conscience. So again, the outrage itself is not enough. And doing action for the sake of action is not enough, because at the end of the day, it's not going to be able to change anything. It's not going to be able for one to become closer to the end goal of liberation. And at the same time, it ends up being something that takes so much space. It takes actually so much media attention and probably redirects it from what is actually happening in Gaza. And I don't think it ends up benefiting anyone. And with that said, and I think with what we discussed on the march that took place in 2009, I still don't quite understand why people are acting surprised. I don't think there is anything to be surprised about. Does that mean we stop trying? I'm not sure, but I think it requires that one tries with a little bit of humility, with understanding, with strategizing.
Angie, I want to just quickly, if you allow me, to read out a quote from the article that I thought was really impactful and sort of encapsulates what you have just been talking about. You wrote, "There's something deeply seductive about collective movement, about being part of a movement that feels historic. But that feeling too can be a kind of privilege, to experience solidarity as a high without having to live its aftermath. What does it mean to hold that emotion alongside a politics of responsibility?" And I think that really sums up what you have just been saying, that inevitably there will be tensions in any solidarity movement. And I think that applies not only to white allies in the movement, but to those who also have passport privilege. And I think it's something to reflect on. But one of the things, and you really hit the nail on the head, is that this has been happening before, that we have had these kinds of issues come up over many years. And there seems to be a sort of a lack of reflectivity, a lack of strategic thinking, and really a lack of learning from history. 2009 was not so long ago. Probably remember it a bit better than you do. But it was a time where there could have been a lot of lessons learned.
No, I really agree with kind of the lessons learned. You know, what are the precedents? What can we do differently? How we can approach things in a way that would actually allow to work? Because at the end of the day, like, I would have loved to see this happen. In reality, it would have been great. But what I saw was a lot of probably misplaced excitement. You know, there is, again, like I said, there's something deeply seductive about not only a collective movement, but also a proximity to an event that might seem historical. You know, everyone will remember the Gaza genocide 10 years from now. So in that moment, I might think that I want to be one of those activists who went there, you know, put my body on the line and tried to break the siege. Even if I ended up not being able to do that, but I would have liked to be part of that. So I think there is something in this point of proximity, but then also the attempt to do something against the backdrop of helplessness without really kind of knowing for sure that this is going to bear fruit.
So this week, there's another flotilla on its way to Gaza, carrying on board a group of international activists. And of course, freedom flotillas have been long part of the struggle in attempting to break the siege on Gaza. Do you have any thoughts about this particular action?
I think, like, when I wrote the article, I mentioned that I remember opening the article was saying that there's three different international protest actions and that each has its own calculus, basically, of strategy and visibility and privilege. I think there's a lot to be said about the Freedom Flotilla, specifically the Madeleine, which relied mostly on high-profile figures more than any of the other older missions. But I think there's something of value, maybe, when you think of it as a form of sustained protest over a large number of years. I think I read somewhere that this is the 37th mission so far. So I think there's a lot of learning from past mistakes. It relies on redoing, you know? So when one of those missions fail, it doesn't mean that it's a fail, like a definite fail. It means that it's a new space opened up for the next one and so on. And I think something can be of value in this attempt and or like this strategy, basically. The other thing is that I think they also rely so much on the aspect of raising awareness, which is not something that I necessarily see as, I don't think it's needed at this point in time. But on the other hand, they also deliver aid. And I think there is, historically speaking, the flotilla has reached Gaza a couple of times, as far as I understand, delivering aid at different points in time. And also the 2010 Freedom Flotilla, it was called the Mavi Marmar. I think it ended up with direct confrontations and violent clashes with the Israeli military. So I think the type of confrontation that it invokes is completely different from the march, for example. And I think people go there also knowing what's at stake. So I might not agree with the framing per se, or maybe smaller tactics, but I think there is something of value or something that could be learned from understanding how something can work as a sustained form of protest as opposed to a one-off. And if it doesn't play out the way it was planned, then we move on with our lives and don't revisit it again.
Yeah, and I think in all fairness as well, like, we are living in an unprecedented moment. I mean, the genocide is for all of us, is a moment of unprecedented horror. It's something that I think none of us could have quite imagined or expected, this level of violence. And so I think it's, you know, on the one hand, it is understandable that people are trying to do anything and everything, but it is precisely because this moment in the Palestinian struggle for liberation is so horrific that necessitates us to slow down and to think more collectively and to think about, you know, what have we learned, to think about strategy over sort of these very flashy feel-good tactics. And that's not, we've said this time and time again throughout this podcast, it's not to say that people come with bad intentions, but I think people don't acknowledge how much work goes in to liberation movements, to revolutions. There's a lot of tedious political work that is necessary and crucial for the movement that is often built on and built up over years and years and years. You know, the various revolutions of the Arab Spring wasn't one moment in time. It wasn't one protest that led to the Arab Spring. It was years and years of organizing and work. And the same is the case for Palestine when there have been moments of uprising. These haven't been sort of just random moments where protest suddenly becomes the uprising itself. It's actually a lot of work that goes into it.
I can maybe jump in and say, like, I agree with you that I don't think any of this is ill intention, but I think it's a little bit misplaced and a little bit inconsiderate of the context. And I think what could be asked here, just to make sure that the framing is correct, you know, the intention is in the right place. This is going to do something that on the long run, or like in the grand scheme of things, can have an impact and change something. I think when we say Gaza is our moral compass, it's not really an empty slogan. And I think one can always ask, is the action that I'm doing centering the dignity of the Palestinians? If you don't have a clear answer to this, then I think you would require to revisit what you're doing. And you keep revisiting until you have a clear answer on how this actually centers the dignity of the Palestinians, not the Palestinians in general. But I think there's a responsibility in how we have to act and how we have to relate to Palestinians. And I think that the question of dignity becomes central to this. And I think secondary to this, or also next to this, would be, will my action put someone else in danger if they don't have the same privileges as me? Like, again, thinking of the ramifications, if I step foot in that square, what does this happen? Who else is affected? Are they affected positively or negatively? And it ends up being like a simple calculation of what's your input, what is the output, and then you start to see, is it worth it or not worth it?
NJ, I think we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Rethinking Palestine. Rethinking Palestine is brought to you by Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network.
If you missed parts of the show, you can go to Security's website at security.ca and listen to it again. All the episodes are archived on our page. Just click on the name of the show and you will find them. You will also find the link to the archive on CFRC's website at cfrc.ca. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.